Blog Talk Radio.
To kill the poor of those Muslim countries. This is trading blood for oil. This is genocide. And to friends fast. Okay. When I speak, it's always for my family, for both sides of my family, as you'll hear about, but in particular this evening, this is for one of my cousins who lived in Baghdad. He's 21 years old, and he's dying from brain cancer. And in my mind, I cannot rule out that this was not our use of depleted uranium that has contributed to this. I speak to you today on behalf of relatives on my mother's side, Ashkenazi Jews who fled their homeland of Austria during Hitler's Anschluss. It is for them that we say never again. I speak to you today on behalf of relatives on my father's side who are not living but dying under the occupation of this administration's deadly foray in Iraq. From the lack of security to the lack of basic supplies to the lack of electricity to the lack of potable water to the lack of jobs to the lack of reconstruction to the lack of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they are much worse off now than before we invaded. Never again should apply to them too.
Right.
Picture this in your mind. A humanitarian worker in Baghdad is quoted as recalling the scene after a bomb blast. I saw a four-year-old boy sitting beside his mother's body, which had been decapitated by the explosion. He was talking to her, asking her what had happened. There is no respite for Iraqis from the suffering inflicted by American weaponry and American racism. During the first Gulf War, destruction of Iraq's electrical grids incapacitated the medical system. What had been a first-class range of facilities known as the jewel of the Arab world. After January 1991, primary health care and preventative services ceased to exist, and with economic sanctions, there were critical shortages of food and life-saving drugs and equipment. Cholera became endemic in Iraq. Easily treatable diseases such as respiratory infections and diarrhea accounted for 70% of the deaths of children under 5 years old. This calamity was the tragic state of Iraqi society when the illegal shock and awe invasion came, and with it, a vastly increased number of patients. With the dissolution of law and order after our invasion came the looting of Iraq's hospitals. Today, lack of security delays the delivery of supplies, and no money is being distributed from the U.S.-operated Ministry of Health. Fallujah. God help us for what we have done to the people of Fallujah. On March 31, 2004, four American civilians lost their lives in Fallujah. They were civilians with military backgrounds. In the same way, a paramilitary death squad in El Salvador, responsible for the brutal rape, torture, and murder of four American nuns, was comprised of civilians. Though they had GPS systems from Blackwater, those systems were not working that day, and they became disoriented. But they should have known long before, when they were boarding a plane to Baghdad, that they were going the wrong way. Perhaps they nobly signed a contract with Blackwater to achieve financial security for their loved ones. But there is a word in the English language to describe an individual who sells out his body, his principles, his soul for monetary reward. That's a congressman. In the same way that Nazi soldiers fell victim to their system during the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, these hired killers from Blackwater got justice served to them on a silver platter. Then revenge was carried out on a people that can truly be identified as civilian. In April 2004, U.S. Marines closed the bridge to the city and the hospital road. This is a war crime. The U.S. military and its vehicles stood at the hospital entrance. This is a war crime. And snipers were positioned on rooftops targeting ambulances and the clinic doors. Between 600 and 800 civilians were killed in that siege, but that wasn't enough. In November 2004, the second major siege of Fallujah began. The Nizal Emergency Hospital, protected by the Geneva Conventions, was leveled to the ground, and Fallujah General Hospital was seized by the U.S. military. Doctors described, "We were tied up and beaten despite being unarmed and having only our medical instruments." Burhan Fasa'a, a cameraman with the Lebanese Broadcasting Company, reported, "There were American snipers on top of the hospital, shooting everyone in sight." In addition, the U.S. military blocked the Iraqi Red Crescent from entering the city for 7 days. The result was a death toll of between 6,000 and 8,000 civilians. This means that the Iraqi death toll in November 2004 alone surpassed the invaders' death toll for all of Operation Enduring Freedom thus far. As we sit here tonight, death, destruction, and war crimes continue in this battered city. As of October 2006, due to the desperate conditions in Iraq of no security, high crime, and targeted assassinations, it is estimated that 18,000 of Iraq's 34,000 physicians have fled the country. 2,000 doctors and 164 nurses have been murdered, and another 250 kidnapped for high-priced ransoms. 68% of Iraqis lack access to safe drinking water. 81% are without proper sewerage. And the segments of the population who suffer the most whenever there is no law and order are women and children. Women have all but disappeared from their roles in the workforce. Once contributors to Iraqi society as teachers, judges, lawyers, doctors, engineers, traffic police, and more, the threat of violence and kidnapping now imprisons many women in their homes. But even there, they are not safe from the terrorism of daily house raids by American soldiers and their subordinate Iraqi police. For the children of these women, during the first 3.5 years of occupation, 270,000 newborns received no immunizations. 800,000 Iraqi children are not in school due to the chaos, lack of security, and severe poverty. According to the State of the World Mothers Report released last month by Save the Children, the chance that an Iraqi child will live beyond age 5 has plummeted faster in Iraq than anywhere else in the world since 1990. In 2005, 1 in 8 Iraqi children died of disease or violence before reaching the age of 5. Operation Enduring Freedom would more appropriately be named Operation Dead Children for everyone involved. As millions of Iraqis suffer and hundreds continue to die every day, it does not matter if you call it civil war, sectarian strife, or democracy. It is by design an American killing field, a smokescreen for stealing oil. Here at home, if we don't care about the welfare of returning veterans who make up one-third of our homeless population, how do we expect to care about the welfare of now over 4 million Iraqi refugees? If we're not caring for the physically and emotionally disabled soldiers at Walter Reed Army Hospital and the more than 200,000 veterans of this, our latest Holocaust, seeking care through the VA system, how do we expect to care about dead and dying Iraqis? If we don't care what happens to American women assaulted and humiliated by their brothers in arms, how do we expect to care about 14-year-old Abir Hamza, raped, slain, and set on fire after her family was murdered by our men in uniform? We have an obligation to every last victim of this illegal aggression because all of this carnage has been done in our name. Since World War II, 90% of the casualties of war are unarmed civilians, a third of them children. Our victims have done nothing to us. From Palestine to Afghanistan to Iraq to Somalia to wherever our next target may be, their murders are not collateral damage. They are the nature of modern warfare. They don't hate us because of our freedoms. They hate us because every day we are funding and committing crimes against humanity. The so-called war on terror is a cover for our military aggression to gain control of the resources of Western Asia. This is sending the poor of this country to kill the poor of those Muslim countries. This is trading blood for oil. This is genocide. And to most of the world, we are the terrorists. In these times, remaining silent on our responsibility to the world and its future is criminal. And in light of our complicity in the supreme crimes against humanity in Iraq and Afghanistan and ongoing violations of the UN Charter and international law, how dare any American criticize the actions of legitimate resistance to illegal occupation? That's really lovely. Thank you so much. How dare we condemn anyone else's violence? Our so-called enemies in Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, our other colonies around the world, and our inner cities here at home are struggling against the oppressive hand of empire, demanding respect for their humanity. They are labeled insurgents or terrorists for resisting rape and pillage by the white establishment, but they are our brothers and sisters in the struggle for justice. The civilians at the other end of our weapons don't have a choice, but American soldiers have choices. And while there may have been some doubt 5 years ago, today we know the truth. Our soldiers don't sacrifice for duty, honor, country. They sacrifice for Kellogg, Brown, and Root. They don't fight for America. They fight for their lives, and their buddies beside them because we put them in a war zone. They're not defending our freedoms. They're laying the foundation for 14 permanent military bases to defend the freedoms of ExxonMobil and British Petroleum. Right. They're not establishing democracy. They're establishing the basis for an economic occupation to continue after the military occupation has ended. Iraqi society today, thanks to American help, is defined by house raids, death squads, checkpoints, detentions, curfews, blood in the streets, and constant violence. We must dare to speak out in support of the Iraqi people who resist and endure the horrific existence we brought upon them through our bloodthirsty imperial crusade. We must dare to speak out in support of those American war resistors, the real military heroes who uphold...
Lila insists that I end it here, and probably she's correct.
Well, because it goes on for quite a long time.
Well, it only went on for two more minutes. But the important thing is that, you know, it's important to get this out. People don't realize how freaking devastated Iraq is and still is to this day. And the murderous, miserable, you know, bastards, they got away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And they're still getting away with it, and they're still doing it. They're still signing up to go kill more Iraqis and more Afghanis and more
Pakistanis.
Well,
we just move on to the next country and create devastation there.
Hip, hip, hooray for the freaking Memorial Day parades, you know what I mean? Like la-di-da and coochie-coo, all right? It's like, kill more. Hey, it's a freaking sick country, folks. We memorialize our murderers.
Our war machine.
Yeah, our war machine.
Which is very, very sad.
Who the hell are we kidding? Who are we kidding?
Well, we're not kidding the rest of the world. We're kidding our
people. Kidding ourselves. We're kidding ourselves.
It's very sad.
You know, so. But that's
what's going on in Iraq and still continuing.
Yeah. And
she spoke very well on it.
That's Dahlia Wofsy. And I highly recommend you can go to YouTube and see a lot of her talks.
I don't know to whom she was speaking, what that group was.
There was many groups that she speaks to. It just happened to be a film.
I didn't know which one she was speaking to.
It didn't say on that. All right. So there will be a new false flag
Will there be a new false flag attack in Chicago?
You know, we don't really care. You don't really care if there is. I don't really care. Do you really care? No, you don't really care.
I do.
Why would I care?
The FDA targets supplement manufacturers and falsely accuses them of selling drugs.
Yeah, that. But the most important thing I have tonight to talk about is one more audio. That's the one on with Ron Paul. If you let me go to that, we could do that tonight because we may not have time later because I want to do that health segment tonight. But there's a bunch of really fascinating things going on. But this is probably
happening in Congress that you don't hear on the mainstream media. It's like Congress isn't doing anything.
No,
but they are. They're doing a lot. And
it's pretty
scary. Well, they aren't really doing anything. You're right when you think that. They're just letting corporations run the place.
Yeah, and they're just, you know, being paid to do it. And now they're about ready to give Obama, you know,
ultimate power.
You become Caesar. And it's really disgusting. So
let's listen to this. The final nails in the coffin. Bill authorizes perpetual worldwide war. And this is Ron Paul talking about this bill.
Right. So onto your seats, folks.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The last nail is being driven into the coffin of the American Republic, yet Congress remains in total denial as our liberties are rapidly fading before our eyes. The process is propelled by unwarranted fear and ignorance as to the true meaning of liberty. It is driven by economic myths, fallacies, and irrational good intentions. The rule of law is constantly rejected, and authoritarian answers are offered as panaceas for all our problems. Runaway welfareism is used to benefit the rich at the expense of the middle class. Who would have ever thought that the current generation and Congress would stand idly by and watch such a rapid disintegration of the American Republic? Characteristic of this epic event is the casual acceptance by the people and the political leaders of the unitary presidency, which is equivalent to granting dictatorial powers to the president. Our presidents can now, on their own, order assassinations, including American citizens, operate secret military tribunals, engage in torture, enforce indefinite imprisonments without due process, order searches and seizures without proper warrants, gutting the Fourth Amendment, ignore the 60-day rule for reporting to the Congress the nature of any military operation as required by the War Powers Resolution, continue the Patriot Act abuses without oversight, wage war at will. Treat all Americans as suspected terrorists at airports with TSA groping and nude x-raying. And the Federal Reserve accommodates by counterfeiting the funds needed and not paid for by taxation and borrowing, permitting runaway spending, endless debt, and special interest bailouts. And all of this is not enough. The abuses and usurpations of the war power are soon to be codified in the National Defense Authorization Act, now rapidly moving its way through Congress. Instead of repealing the 2001 authorization for the use of military force, as we should now that bin Laden is dead and gone, Congress is planning to massively increase the war power of the president. Though an opportunity presents itself to end the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, Congress, with bipartisan support, obsesses on how to expand the unconstitutional war power of the president he already holds. The current proposal would allow a president to pursue war anytime, any place, for any reason, without congressional approval. Many believe this would even permit military activity against American suspects here at home. The proposed authority does not reference the 9/11 attacks. It would be expanded to include the Taliban and associated forces, a dangerously vague and expansive definition of our potential enemies. There is no denial that the changes in Section 1034 totally eliminates the hard-fought-for restraint on presidential authority to go to war without congressional approval achieved at the Constitutional Convention. Congress's war authority has been severely undermined since World War II, beginning with the advent of the Korean War, which was fought solely under a UN resolution. Even today, we're waging war in Libya without even consulting with the Congress, similar to how we went to war in Bosnia in the 1990s under President Clinton. The three major reasons for our constitutional conventions were to guarantee free trade and travel among the states, make gold and silver legal tender, and abolish paper money, and strictly limit the executive branch's authority to pursue war without congressional approval. But today, Federal Reserve notes are legal tender, gold and silver are illegal. The Interstate Commerce Clause is used to regulate all commerce at the expense of the free trade among the states. And now, the final nail is placed in the coffin of congressional responsibility for the war power, delivering this power completely to the president, a sharp and huge blow to the concept of our republic. In my view, it appears that the fate of the American Republic is now sealed, unless these recent trends are quickly reversed. The saddest part of this tragedy is that all of these horrible changes are being done in the name of patriotism and protecting freedom. They are justified by good intentions while believing the sacrifice of liberty is required for our safety. Nothing could be further from the truth. More sadly is the conviction that our enemies are driven to attack us for our freedoms and prosperity and not because of our deeply flawed foreign policy that has generated justifiable grievances and has inspired the radical violence against us. Without this understanding, our endless, unnamed, and undeclared wars will continue, and our wonderful experiment with liberty will end. And I yield back the balance of my time.
Okay. And that's Ron Paul. You can understand what's happening here. We're about ready to give away the last bastion of our freedom. These bastards, these incredible bastards. But, you know, thankfully you get a Ron Paul who's standing up for our rights. Nobody else seems to be. Before we bring our guest up, in the next 5 minutes or so, I wanted to read this article called Imperial Eye on Pakistan. Yes, folks, that's the next war that Obama seems to want to be waging. As the purported assassination of Osama bin Laden has placed the focus on Pakistan, it is vital to assess the changing role of Pakistan in broad geostrategic terms, and in particular the changing American strategy toward Pakistan. The recent reported assassination was a propaganda ploy aimed at targeting Pakistan. To understand this, it is necessary to examine how America has, in recent years, altered its strategy in Pakistan in the direction of destabilization. In short, Pakistan is an American target. Right? The reason Pakistan's growing military and strategic ties to China, America's primary goal strategic rival, in the game and the great game of global hegemony, any country that impedes America's world primacy, even one as historically significant to America as Pakistan, may be sacrificed upon the altar of war. And, okay. And hang on a second here.
The part one of Pakistan in Pieces examines the changing views of the American strategic community, particularly the military and intelligence circles towards Pakistan. In particular, there is a general knowledge that Pakistan will very likely continue to be destabilized and ultimately collapse. What is not mentioned in these assessments, however, is the role of the military and intelligence communities in making this a reality, a veritable self-fulfilling prophecy. This part also examines the active on-the-ground changes in American strategy in Pakistan, with increasing military incursions into the country. In December of 2000, the CIA released a report of global trends to the year 2015, which stated that by 2015, Pakistan will be more fractious, isolated, and dependent on international financial assistance. Further, it was predicted Pakistan will not easily recover from decades of political and economic mismanagement, divisive politics, lawlessness, corruption, and ethnic friction. Nascent democratic reforms will produce little change in the face of opposition from entrenched political elite and radical Islamic parties. Further domestic decline would benefit Islamic political activists who may significantly increase their role in national politics and alter the makeup and cohesion of the military, once Pakistan's most capable institution. In a climate of continuing domestic turmoil, the central government's control will be reduced to the Punjabi heartland and the economic hub of Karachi. The report further analyzed the trends developing in relation to the Indian-Pakistan standoff in the region. The threat of major conflict between India and Pakistan will overshadow all other regional issues during the next 15 years. Continued turmoil in Afghanistan and Pakistan will spill over into the Kashmir and other areas of the subcontinent, prompting continued turmoil in Afghanistan and Pakistan will spill over into the Kashmir and other areas of the subcontinent, prompting Indian leaders to take more aggressive, preemptive, and retaliatory actions. India's conventional military advantage over Pakistan will widen as a result of New Delhi's superior economic position. In 2005, the Times of India reported on a U.S. National Intelligence Council report written in conjunction with the CIA, a Yugoslavian, like say, the year 2015, Pakistan would be a failed state. Had interprovincial rivalries and struck control over its nuclear weapons and complete Talibanization.
Hello.
Oh, there's Gail. Hi, Gail. How are you?
Hi, I'm good.
Are you ready to be on the show?
I think so.
Oh, good. I was just finishing up an article here, and I'll be with you in a moment. I just want to mention to folks that they can get this article, Imperial Eye on Pakistan, by
Global Researchers.ca.
And it's written by Andrew Gavin Marshall, so you can get to that article. It's quite a long one. But right now we have our guest on the phone, Gail Khoury-Townsend. Welcome to the show, Gail.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, good. If you could just speak up a little louder and into the phone, we'll hear you a little clearer.
Okay. How's that? Can you hear me now?
Oh, that's much better. And we introduced you at the opening of the show to let folks know that you're going on a special mission in the month of June, and I'd like you to talk about that. How you managed to get on the flotilla, what that required, and just exactly what you folks will be doing when you get to Palestine.
Okay, well, I'm going to be on the U.S. boat to Gaza, and the boat is called the Audacity of Hope. It's named after President Obama's memoir. The boat will be part of an international flotilla of at least a dozen boats, probably more, and they will be from countries all over Europe, from some countries in the Middle East, some countries from Asia, I think, Canada,
mm-hmm.
and the U.S. We'll be sailing. We'll be sailing in late June, and we are doing it to basically break Israel's illegal siege of Gaza. We'll
Could you be just a little louder, Gil? Maybe
we're
kind of losing your voice there.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's excellent.
Yeah, that's much better. Thank you.
Okay. So basically, we maintain that the Israeli blockade of Gaza is a clear violation of international human rights and of maritime law. There are a million and a half people in Gaza, and they've been basically cut off from the world for the last 5 years by Israel. And it's not just Israel. It's Israel supported by the United States government. And that's why it's so important for us to go. My feeling is that despite the fact that that Palestine, which includes Gaza, is under this illegal occupation by Israel, it is still a sovereign nation. It is a sovereign nation. And sovereign nations have control of their borders. And even though Palestine doesn't have control of its borders right now, by sailing to Gaza, the U.S. boat to Gaza and the rest of the flotilla are affirming Palestine's sovereignty.
We're having a little problem hearing you, Gail.
I don't know what to do about that. Yeah, I'm speaking right into the phone. Can you hear me
now? As soon as you do that, it sounds good. Okay.
That sounds really good. I'm speaking right into the speaker.
Okay.
So we're not carrying. The other thing is we're not carrying any humanitarian aid. What we're asking people to do is to write letters to Gaza. It's called the To Gaza with Love campaign, and we're asking people to write letters or postcards or emails that we will bring to the people of Gaza. Today, by the way, is the one-year anniversary of the disaster and tragedy that happened last year when a flotilla went to Gaza. And on this day last year, the Israeli military attacked a Turkish ship, the Mavi Marmara, and Israeli commandos came down from a helicopter onto the ship, and they basically executed 9 people, including an American citizen, by shooting them at close range.
We remember that very well, yeah.
Yeah. And
was anyone held responsible for that, Gail?
No one was held responsible for that. There was an investigation that found that Israel had had violated, well, basically violated international law. The waters outside of Palestine, outside of Gaza, is the Mediterranean Sea, and the boats did not enter into Israeli waters. They went into the waters of Gaza, and so, you know, what it was an act of piracy by Israel on the high seas. And so they came onto this boat, they killed 9 people, they injured many, many other people, and then they kidnapped the rest of the passengers and forced the boat to go to Israel, where they detained people. And not only did they detain people, they stole all of their stuff. They stole, like, millions of dollars worth of electronic equipment, cell phones, laptops, cameras, all kinds of stuff, which they never did give back. And not only that, they also stole credit cards, and some of the people, you know, found all these charges on their credit cards, you know, for beers in Tel Aviv and stuff like that.
What a wonderful country, isn't it? wonderful people, these Zionists. Ah. So
yes.
tell us how do you... You know, going there, how are you preparing yourself for that mentally as well as physically?
Yeah. What are you bringing with you?
A can of mace or something, or any kind of.
Do you and the others that are going on this flotilla feel that you have to bring anything for your own protection?
Oh, we're absolutely no. If you're hinting at weapons or any kind of protective stuff, we're absolutely committed to nonviolence. There will be no weapons of any kind on this boat, nothing. And we are absolutely open to having any international body search the boat and confirm that. We're committed
now,
to nonviolence.
Is anyone trying to discourage your trip?
Everyone is trying to discourage the trip, starting with the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, who has gone to the United Nations, the United States, European countries, and telling the governments to stop the flotilla. But the thing is, the governments of all of the countries have nothing to do with the flotilla. The flotilla is entirely civil society project. It's being organized by nonprofit groups everywhere, and we raised our own funds. It's not funded by government. The government has no control. However, we do ask and we expect that the United States government will protect its citizens. And that's another thing that we're asking for. We're asking people to actually track us. If they go to ustogaza.org, there's a website that will give you all kinds of information, including you can sign up for alerts that will go out, tracking the boat. And if the Israelis are foolish enough to attack us as they attacked the flotilla last year, we're hoping that U.S. citizens will flood their representatives' phones with messages asking their congressmen and their senators and the White House, too, to protect us, to call Israel, to demand that Israel not attack us and not detain us, and to just let us go on our peaceful humanitarian way.
Netanyahu has gone to the UN and spoken to the U.S. government to intercede and prevent you from going. Has he taken a step further? Have you been threatened with attack?
Well, actually, there was an article in Haaretz yesterday in which he said, you know, that if we disobey the Israeli military, they will use force against us. So yeah, there have been threats, definitely. And I think it's extremely unseemly, to say the least, for the head of a state to threaten unarmed civilians on a humanitarian mission with force. You know, it's almost unthinkable that a head of state who should be wise and diplomatic would do that in the international press. But we are talking about Benjamin Netanyahu, the drama queen. If you recall his.
Can you? I hate to keep asking you, Gil, but I don't have any. I have my controls as high as they are going, but just to speak a little bit louder into the phone.
Okay, how's that?
Can you hear us all right? By the way, I meant to ask you that.
Well, there's a lot of noise on the line, but I can hear you all right.
Oh, good.
Okay. Yeah, when you speak like that, we can hear you very clearly.
Okay.
Boats in this flotilla, I didn't really exactly hear what you said. Are those boats from other countries, or are the boats American boats as well? I wasn't quite sure. I didn't hear your answer to that.
No, there's just one American boat, the Audacity of Hope. And
yeah.
There are boats from, let me see if I can find the countries. I just saw an email. Oh, and guess who's going to be on the boat? Alice Walker.
Oh. Alice Walker.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who that is. I'm sorry. Who is Alice Walker? My ignorance.
Famous American writer, poet.
Poet and writer.
Yeah.
Still doesn't.
She's been on TV a number of times. Actually, Oprah Winfrey's had her on.
That's why I haven't seen her. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Hey.
And there's some amazing people on this boat. One of them is an 80-something-year-old woman, Hedy Epstein, her name is, and she's a Holocaust survivor. She has her own website. She was on the boat last year, too. Excuse me. The Israelis treated her very badly, very badly.
Really?
But the Israelis treated all the Holocaust survivors very badly. In
they took their money.
They stole all their money for
crying. They took their reparation money.
Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing how they've treated their own people as,
Well,
I guess there's no question why they would treat others as badly, and so they treat their own people the same way.
Well, they're Zionists, and then they're Jews. They're very different. That's why you have a lot of Jewish people who will stand up against Zionism, but you hear very little about that in the media.
Oh, no.
That's true, because the Zionists like to pretend that they speak for all Jewish people, and they don't. They do not speak for all Jewish people. I mean, the Jewish tradition is not one of ethnic cleansing, as the Zionists have done in Palestine.
Their tradition is.
Exactly so. And there are many Jewish friends on this boat. And it's wonderful, and I think there is a growing in America that there is a growing unhappiness with the Israeli government and its abuses of power. And
there has to be, but it's being crammed down our throats by AIPAC and by Barack Obama and by everybody, every other congressman and nitwit that elected. It's really pathetic. And there's no one that's talking out against them, nobody, and power, because they're afraid of them. But I don't know. I mean it's a losing battle, and I've got to tell you, Gil, we appreciate you and those people on that boat and the people like you and your groups and stuff who are trying to make a difference, trying to speak out, because. My God, there's not that many voices out there.
So
there's a growing number of voices out there, Leo, and I honestly don't believe that it's a losing battle. I'm a strong adherent to Martin Luther King's, one of his famous quotes was, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." And it's been a long time coming for the Palestinians, justice, I mean. But,
that arc
is bending towards them, and Israeli occupation and the illegality of its siege is not sustainable. Excuse me, it's just not sustainable, and you can see the end coming. There are other developments that are very important that have happened in this past month, and one of them.
Well, I think so. That the opening of the Egyptian border with Gaza was a very big thing.
Yeah. Well, that. that follows some really momentous things, as you know, the overthrow of Mubarak by a peaceful, just the peaceful power of the people. I mean, literally the power of the people overthrew Mubarak. And then the most another amazing thing that led to the opening was the reconciliation of Fatah and Hamas in Palestine.
Yes, that's very significant.
And it was the Egyptians who broke with that, the Egyptians after Mubarak, because Mubarak had been pretending to broker reconciliation between the two groups. But he hated from Hamas, and so he always undermined Hamas. But now there seems to be unity, and they'll be forming a unity government. And then the other humongous thing is that the PA, the Palestinian Authority, is planning to go to the UN in September and ask the General Assembly to recognize Palestine on the 1967 border. So that's huge.
Do you think that's got any chance of passing or not, that 67 border?
Well, the thing is, I think it does have a chance of, well, it could have a chance of passing if, the U.S. and Israel are going to work their hardest to undermine that.
Oddly enough, what surprised me is that Barack Obama wanted the 67 border.
He came out and supported it, but I was...
Well, sort of.
He sort of, and then he came away with
but
it.
Not
he gave
really.
With,
not
gave
really.
Another.
1967 border with exchanges of land, but who's going to dictate which lands are exchanged? It's not going to be the Palestinian Authority. It's going to be Israel. Then he says, and every country has the right to defend itself. Then he says, Palestine will be demilitarized. So if every country has the right to defend itself, why should Palestine be different from any other country?
Especially when its neighbor is the
fourth most powerful military in the world and has nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
He's just he's
so Gail, you'll be leaving June 20th or 21st?
Yeah, we're gathering all the Americans anyway. I don't know about anybody else, but the Americans are gathering in Athens on the 21st of June, and then we'll be sailing from there.
How long a sail is it from Athens to Palestine, to the Gaza?
As far as I'm concerned, too long. I'm not a good sailor. I'll be wearing my life jacket the whole time.
I'm glad to hear that.
I'm not really sure. I think it's probably about 2 days.
Okay, and what is your plan exactly? You're sailing to which...
We're sailing to Gaza City there, where the port
okay.
is.
And then if by chance you do dock there, what is the next thing that you'll be doing?
Well, then we'll stay and hang out with the Gazan people for a couple of days. We'll do stuff like, whatever talents the individual passengers have. We can do workshops or have meetings with the Palestinians. Like I'm an EMT, so I might meet with the Red Crescent people and exchange stuff about our work as EMTs. Or I would love to meet with some Palestinian journalists and talk about our work as journalists. Other people will be meeting with people in their kinds of their kinds of work, and basically just showing solidarity with the Palestinian people. And then we'll leave. We'll go back on the boat, and we'll go back to Athens and come home and tell
you about that. What kind of communication is coming from Gaza? Are they allowing out? Can you telephone Gaza? Can you talk to people there? Regular communications, or is that being blocked or all censored or what?
No, you can phone Gaza. You can call Gaza.
You can.
And they have they have internet and cell phones and stuff like that.
Now, is this boat going to have a film crew on it? Is somebody going to be documenting this?
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, there'll be lots of people with cameras. although we're told not to bring anything that we don't want to lose because, as I said, the Israelis last year, they just took everything. They took everything and they didn't give it back. However, a few people managed to get film out, and so there is documentation of what happened. But one of the things the Israelis did was they blocked the communications on the boat. I mean, that's one of the things.
They blocked the communication?
Yeah.
Well, they'll probably try that again this time.
Yeah.
And you said your particular boat is bringing postcards and written letters and things. What about the other boats in the flotilla? Do they have different missions?
Well, you must have supplies also, right, and different things that you're bringing?
No, we're not bringing any humanitarian aid. I think some of the other boats are bringing humanitarian aid. Like last year, I think they brought cement for rebuilding homes because the Israelis, after their Operation Cast Lead at the beginning of 2009, in which they killed 1,400 people, including around 400 children, and destroyed 5,000 buildings, including homes and schools and hospitals and the UN building, they haven't allowed the Palestinians in Gaza to bring in cement and building materials to repair, the damage that they made.
So what are these people living in, tents or something, or how are they?
Yeah, they live in tents and, just whatever, temporary kind of... temporary buildings. Some of them live in the destroyed their destroyed homes, if there's a couple of walls.
Now, are you hoping to be able to connect with our friend Mazen Kinsella?
Well, Mazen is in the West Bank, and I don't know. I have the feeling that we won't be able to travel from Gaza through Israel to the West Bank.
Okay.
The only way we could do that would be to go go through Egypt into Jordan and then around that way. But we still have to come through the Israeli border patrol. So, I don't know. It would be
nice. Could you have possibly gone to Israel and then into Gaza?
No, they're not. They don't let anybody in.
They don't let anybody in, huh?
No.
Unbelievable.
Or out.
Or out.
You have a lot of Gaza people who are sick, and until the Rafah border was opened this week, you have people dying for lack of medical care because the Israelis won't let them into.
How many people actually live in Gaza?
1.5 million, and the huge majority. I mean, I'm not sure what of the statistics, but more than 50% are people under 30.
Wow.
young population, like 60 or 70% or something.
Now, are the majority there still firm believers in Hamas or what?
I don't really know. I think Hamas was elected in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as they were elected, United States and Israel boycotted them and put the clamp on them and did this blockade and that. So much for our support of democracy, right? We say we support democracy, but when a people democratically elect their leaders and we don't like the leaders, that's it.
We've done that consistently everywhere around the world, and we're doing it constantly. It's the biggest farce going.
Now, do you think the answer is a two-state, a free, separate state of Israel and a free Palestine?
No, I don't. And the reason why I don't is that the Israelis have made that impossible because they built illegal settlements all through the West Bank that cut off the Palestinian sections from each other. So, like, picture an oval, say, and that's the West Bank. Well, there are bands of settlements that cut across maybe a fifth of the way down, then there's another bend half the way down and another bend, three-fifths of the way down, so that each Palestinian section is isolated, bent, like a Bantustan, like in...
So how do they, how does O'Brien dead, expect there to be a two-state solution.
Well, he doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, that's absurd. If it's an impossibility geographically any longer, then his whole concept of peace is crazy. All right, it's not based in reality. So how is that? How is it possible? It's going to have to be a one state.
Well, I mean,
solution.
I think, yeah. I think, you know.
Yeah, how is it going to be?
Like a democratic state is what Gail is thinking.
Right.
Right now, it's not a democracy; it's a theocracy.
Yeah.
Well, it's not
even
that.
Not even that, I guess.
You know, in Israel, there are, I mean, one-fifth of the population, or more than one-fifth of the population in the part of Palestine, the part of historic Palestine known as Israel, has over a million Palestinians, Palestinian Israelis. If you consider Israeli-ness nationality, it's a nationality, right? Just like American is a nationality.
Yeah.
So there are over a million Palestinian Israelis in
But they have no rights. I mean,
they have some rights, but not. They don't have equal rights, and they don't have services. They don't have the same services. They pay taxes, but they don't get, you know, the same services for their schools and roads and health care and all that. So
they're also aren't they also being kicked out of their homes?
Yeah, some of them. In
Jerusalem, they're being evicted. They're being tossed out on the streets. They're being their property's being taken over.
Especially in East Jerusalem,
which is
illegally occupied, but the Israelis claim that Jerusalem is their eternal capital, undivided.
Right.
So they're kicking out the Palestinians from their the traditional Arab sections of the city, including the old city, and they've demolished thousands and thousands of homes, thousands. There and at the so-called border. The border between Gaza and Egypt, the border between northern Gaza and southern Israel. You know, there's great huge strips like of land that they have cleared, and it's farmland, and the farmers can't even go to their land, you know, within 3,000 yards of the border because they get shot.
You know, I meant to ask you, how is, like, Britain, the British unions were very, very adamant about divesting from, anything with Israel.
Yeah.
Is that still happening? We don't hear anything. I mean, the mainstream media is just, in this country, as well as the British BBC, you hear absolutely nothing from there either. What have you heard?
No, the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, is growing. You know, globally is growing.
Oh, it is, but we're not really hearing about it too much. I mean,
you have to know where to look. I mean, you don't look and.
Where are you looking?
Don't look at Fox News. You know. Well,
where are you looking? Give us
something. I'm going to tell you. If you give me a chance, I will tell you where to look.
The
best place to keep track of this is PACB. Let me just call it up. PACBI. Let me just call it. I know it by its acronym, but let me just. It's the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. And I'm going to give you the website. The website is PACBI.org.
PACBI.org.
P-A-C-E-I.
P as in Palestinian. A-C-B-I.org. And the Palestinian, this website includes, if you look, you know, if you go there and you look at its history and about us and all that stuff, this is the group of Palestinians who, back in 2005, I believe it was, basically kicked off the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions campaign. And it was a year after the International Court of Justice in 2004 gave a ruling that said the Israeli wall, the wall that the Israelis call so benignly, the separation wall, which is actually like a 30-foot-high concrete barbed wire electrified barrier, apartheid wall of hatred, as we call it, is illegal. And furthermore, the International Court of Justice said all of the settlements are illegal. And so this group of Palestinian activists, or in civil society people, theater people, writers, scholars, academics, started this boycott, divestment, sanctions movement.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the best place to get information about it.
Right.
Has that picked up any traction at all in this country?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, that's the thing about, that's the one thing about, you know, if, I was just reading this really interesting thing. Let me see if I can find it. You know who Jeff Halper is? He's an American, Israeli who lives in Israel, and he's the head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. And his group, they have rebuilt houses that the Israelis tear down. One in particular family, they've rebuilt it 5 times. But he says, you know, he does this thing about picture the day after the United Nations General Assembly recognizes Palestine. He says everything that he calls it the matrix of control. Israel has this matrix of control. And if you Google that term, you'll find out what he means by it. He says
the matrix of control.
Yeah, just collapses. This whole matrix of control that Israel has built over the last 44 years, since 1967, over the Palestinians, has collapses. He says, the state will be sovereign. He says, all of the campaigns for pursuing Palestinian rights, including BDS, will now focus on one single unifying goal, getting Israel out of Palestine. No negotiations over borders, no negotiations over settlement. It'll be illegal, and the BDS campaign globally could really kick off. There could be sanctions against selling arms or selling anything to Israel once it is recognized as a state. However, this is really, really important. He says, it must be made clear that the Palestinian vision is not of a two-state, quote, solution, but rather of a two-state stage in a process that will ultimately result in a single state, democratic, binational, or part of a regional confederation. The very dynamics of two peoples sharing the same land in peace and mutual relations, together with the existence of a Palestinian community inside Israel and the right of refugees to truly return home, lead to further evolution. And he says it may take decades, and it'll take decades, you know, because you have all those crazy people both on both sides, really, crazy settlers who, you know, who don't want Palestinians anywhere, crazy Palestinians who, you know, can never get over what has happened. So it will take work, but it's possible. It's possible, and I believe it's going to happen.
Gail, do you have any sense of the populace of Israel, you know, what percentage would be sympathetic toward a single state solution or any solution at all?
I don't have a sense, and I think
it's
hard to gauge. And you read these different polls, and some say, you know, some say more than 50%. But then you look at the government, and you think of all the people who voted for these. Don't let me say bad words on the radio. You know, people voted in that government, voted for Netanyahu.
Well, sometimes that's a presumption. Maybe their elections are fixed. You don't know.
But Hamas absolutely will not accept any peace with Israel. Is that true?
Well, no, I don't think that's true. I mean, they offered a long-term, a 40-50 year truce.
Really?
They offered that. Yes, they did. And you don't hear about these things. They also accepted the two-state situation.
Mm-hmm.
They're not stupid people. I mean, the people in Hamas are very well educated. They're doctors and lawyers and engineers, and you know, highly educated people. They're, it's not like they...
In order to survive this long.
Yeah, they acknowledge that Israel exists. They're not going to. They're not going to say, and nobody else in Palestine is going to say that Israel has a right to exist, or that it has a right to exist as a Jewish state, which is what Israel is now demanding. Because every time you agree to something that Israel wants, they raise the goal. They then demand something more, you know. So first it was like they demanded that people acknowledge Israel's right to exist. Now it's demand that Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. Well, what does that mean? It means that if you're not Jewish, then you don't have the same rights. It's essentially, it's basically a racist state.
Because I keep reading certain articles on the Ethiopian like the Ethiopian Jews, how they're discriminated against, how any ethnic difference, right, is being not purged but segregated from the normal society. Is that the saddest thing
about that is that the indigenous Jews of the Holy Land, in other words, the people who have lived there, like the indigenous Christians and Muslims, are also discriminated against. They're called Mizrahi Jews. Mizrahi Jews of the Middle East who've lived in the Middle East forever, and they are indigenous. But the European Jews who are the settler colonists who have come there and who continue to steal Palestinian land, they're not indigenous people. They're invaders and settler colonists, and they do discriminate against other groups.
Sure.
And they're the ones that are in power.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have all the power.
Mm-hmm.
So, what kind of an insurgency or protest are you seeing from these other groups?
On Nakba Day, which was May 15th.
Organized protests, yeah. What did you say?
May 15th is known as Nakba, N-A-K-B-A Day, and it means the catastrophe, and it signifies the day that Israel unilaterally declared itself a state back in 1948, and when it did that, it ethnically cleansed 750,000 or more indigenous Palestinians from their homes. So the Israelis celebrated as their war of independence. Excuse me.
They celebrated all their wars, Yom Kippur and all this stuff. It wouldn't surprise me they celebrated that as well.
But this is the first time that the Palestinians in large numbers came out to protest, and I think it definitely they were inspired by the protests in Tunisia and Egypt. But it's very difficult because of like this matrix of control that Israel has imposed on the Palestinians with their roadblocks and their checkpoints and, you know, there are tanks at the bottom of the street, and there's soldiers everywhere.
I heard there were 50,000.
It's very, very hard for large numbers.
Was it really exciting to hear that? Must have really shook the Israelis to see that many people got out.
Yeah, but they killed a whole lot of people.
I know they did, yeah.
You know, the Israelis killed a couple of dozen people.
That's sick.
They always pay such a high price, the Palestinians.
Right.
I don't know how the Palestinian people do it. They're living in an open-air prison, basically.
I can't imagine
what life must be like there. It must just be grueling and dreadful.
And to have no support. I mean, no real military or allied support for their plight anywhere in the world, except isolated pockets like, you know, stuff like that, but I mean, there's no military support, and there's no. I mean, are there any countries right now that are aligning with Palestine or with the or with Hamas or, you know, other than Iran? I guess Iran is still strongly supporting them. Is that correct or no?
Iran and Syria, yeah. But you know, the thing that I always find fascinating is, you know, the Israelis and the Americans always bash Iran and say, oh, Iran is supplying Hamas with these weapons and all these, you know, high-quality weapons. Well, where are they? You know, where
yeah.
are they? If they have all these high-quality weapons, how come these stupid rockets that they send off from time to time never go anywhere? I mean, they never hit anything.
Yeah, and you know what surprised me is these weapons and these IEDs, all right, that they were talking about were all built in Iran. Well, it turns out many of those, or most of those, were built in England. They found these roadside bombs to be built in England.
I haven't heard of any roadside bombs in Palestine. Why would
no, not in Palestine. No, no, the ones that they're supposedly using in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. All right, that they're saying, oh,
made
Iran.
In England?
Yeah, they're actually, a lot of them are made in England. Right,
yeah.
Not Iran, you know. So it's like, it's such a.
As long as they sell arms, they don't care who they.
Yeah, so if they sell arms, they don't care who they sell them to, I guess.
But you know, this whole hostility towards Iran. I mean, if you think back to just before the Bush administration, the late 1990s, when those
yeah.
neocons were drawing up their plans for, you know, global control. I mean, they had their axis of evil thing, and they had this plan to, you know, to destroy
right.
Iran,
right. Remember that?
Iraq,
yeah.
Iran, Syria. There was a whole line of countries that they were going to take over. And
yeah.
they pretty much, you know, they've done Iraq, certainly.
But they really can't get Iran, which is, you know, and they haven't been able to touch North Korea.
Where things are getting very touchy in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yes, yes.
China has a huge interest.
I've already threatened.
Oh, actually,
I've already threatened the United States not to touch Pakistan, or there'd be war.
That's right.
And
that was alarming, wasn't it?
I'm sorry.
That was alarming. That was pretty amazing.
I wasn't really too surprised because they're right on each other's border, for crying out loud, you know.
Hmm.
It's no different if China started butting heads with Mexico, you know what I mean?
Or Canada, we wouldn't be
or
too
Canada,
happy.
Or Canada, yeah. So I guess that's the same thing. And for some reason, I don't know why, but for some reason, all of these countries that we're in war with, okay, are butting up against these other countries. You know, and Americans don't understand, all right, that, you know, don't see that Pakistan is next to India, is next to China, you know, and right next to Afghanistan.
There's a regional significance.
Yeah, so
to
I mean, and they're trying to protect their borders from aggressors. I mean, obviously, Pakistan and India have been at war for many, many years and have been aggressors. And Afghanistan has always been a problem and with Pakistan. I mean, Pakistan has, like, I guess, 180 million people. Is that correct? It's a huge country.
I don't
know
what the population is, but I know that the partition of India in Pakistan is another terrible example of how destructive partition is.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Just as historic Palestine was divided into Israel and the West Bank. I mean, partition of an indigenous population is a bad idea. North Korea, South Korea, you know, it just...
Another problem is that, see, the news that we get out of Pakistan is so limited, but they had that huge flood. I think it was last year or so. Remember that 4 million people were displaced. Remember that?
Yeah, too.
And but
Leo, there's the news.
Sorry.
You know, with the miracle of the internet, the news that you get out of anywhere is not limited if you go to the right places. And I would suggest that news of Pakistan and all points, you know, Asian. that you go to the Asian Times, Asia Times, that's at atimes.com, A-T-I-M-E-S.com, and there you'll get
a lot of...
A-T what? A-T-I-M-E-S.com, Asia Times.
N-E-S.com.
Asiatimes.com.
Oh, Asia Times, okay.
Yeah, but just, it's just atimes.com.
Yeah, I just wrote it down.
Okay.
Thank you, Gail.
Yeah.
I will check it out, too.
Yeah, it's just, you know, Americans need to just explore a bit to find the news, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, most Americans don't even know where Missouri is or something, you know what I mean?
Well, we have to find different internet addresses to find exactly what's happening in the world.
Well, that's another thing, yeah. With the censorship there, it's very difficult to find enough news, you know, or not enough news, but the unfiltered information, you know.
Yeah. You know, there's great news in England with the Independent and the Guardian. Go to Spiegel for English language page.
You find the Guardian to be do you
a
like,
good resource?
Do you find that to be
good?
To be somewhat.
Sometimes we get things from there,
so,
but not always.
Good Middle Eastern stuff, I think.
Really? Yeah.
Monitor is pretty good. Haaretz for Israel is supposed to be their liberal newspaper, but you want to read it,
Haaretz, I do, yeah.
You want to read Jerusalem Post because you want to know, what they're thinking.
What's a good Palestinian paper?
I go to the Palestine Chronicle. It's not a newspaper, so it doesn't give you everyday news. But for daily news, I would go to Man.
What's the name?
We didn't hear that. Palestine.
Okay.
What?
It's Ma'an News. It's MAANNEWS.net.
WS. Okay.
.net.
Man News. MAANNEWS.
.net.
.net.
Yeah. That's like the Daily News. It's a Daily News agency. They're pretty good.
Oh, okay. Great.
Now, Gail, on your trip, are you going to be keeping in touch, like on your phone? Do you have like a Facebook account or something that you'll be writing things daily on your trip?
Or even your own blog?
Or your own blog?
Yeah, I was thinking of doing that. The only thing is, I don't want to bring my laptop if it's going to be stolen. So
what about on your phone?
Yeah, I don't
Do
want
you have internet
phone
on your phone?
I can't really type. I can't really write on my phone. So I'm actually thinking of buying one of those little 2.5-pound notebooks,
Yeah.
A little notebook, yeah.
That's probably worth it.
Yeah. I think they're a couple of $100. And yeah, maybe I'll do that.
Would you blog or would you Facebook or what? Do you have any idea of what you're going to do?
No, I hadn't really thought about it yet. But I think doing a blog might be a good idea, right? Where I could just post on.
Yeah.
I could just post on the Corner Report, right? I don't have to set up a whole new blog.
Do the Corner Report. And the other thing I wanted to ask you, you'll have your phone, right?
I'm going to have a phone. It might not be... I don't want to take my iPhone because they're expensive and I don't want to...
You don't want to lose that, yeah.
I might get one of those phones that you just put money in, You buy time on them.
Oh, okay.
Oh, one of those, yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Or you can get... I just saw an ad for AT&T. I don't know if what you have there. They're giving free camera phones now online. Yeah.
They,
get your own free camera phone online only.
That might be worth it.
Yeah.
So, rather than your good expensive phone, you could lose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those are worth a couple. Those are $100 phones. But if you lose it, it's free. You didn't pay for it, I guess.
Yeah.
So it's worth looking into.
I don't want to have to pay another.
I just saw that yesterday, I think.
Well, we do hope that when you come back, that you'll be on again and tell us about your trip, what's happened. Our hope was that we could talk to you by phone while you were on your trip, if possible. I don't know if you have a fixed number of minutes, whether you can do that. But think about it and let us know what kind of phone service you're going
to
have.
Or even if we could call you, and if it's not a cost to you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
As soon as I know what I'm doing in terms of communications, definitely I'll let you know.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
That would be great when we could get your firsthand experience right in the moment. Would be wonderful.
Be a lot of fun.
And
we wish you all the best on that. And we'll talk. We hope to get together with you before you leave.
Okay.
And anyway, I want to thank you so much for being on with us tonight, Gail.
Oh,
and
for asking me.
And we wish you
a very
remind people, go to ustogaza.org and sign up for alerts.
ustogaza.org.
Okay.
Sign
and
up for alerts and please send emails. You'll find instructions where to send them. Emails to Gaza with love. Just expressions of solidarity and hope and good wishes to the people of Gaza that they are.
That's the ustogaza.org?
Yeah, ustogaza, one word, .org.
And you can just send stuff to that to.
When you get on the site, it'll tell you what you can do.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Gail, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Have a good night.
Good night, Gail.
Bye.
That was Gail Corey-Tonsing talking to us about Palestine and her up-and-coming trip to the Gaza, the flotilla that's going to be leaving Athens in June. There's an American boat, the Audacity of Hope. The Audacity of Hope,
And we're going to, we got a few minutes, we're going to go to have a little
music break.
And then we'll be back right after that. So let's do that, and be back in a few minutes. Actually, it's the same song, so it's not right. How about oops, see that one? Just have a couple of songs here that were this. I think I'm gonna forget that all about that here, unless I get something better. I'm gonna go to this one's my favorite song of all time, so here we go. I'm gonna play this one. Chernobyls is it?
Good question.
Yeah. And we have San Francisco. This is from the Shoah, Palestinian Holocaust. Interesting, it was from Palestine. Huh?
Mm-hmm. But, the world's second big nuclear disaster occurred at Chernobyl Reactor Number 4 in Ukraine on April 26, 1986. Simply tagged as Chernobyl, it is what the next big and well-known and nuke disaster after the American Three Mile Island on March 28, 1979, came to be called. Chernobyl ejected 30% of one 192-ton, three-month-old reactor core. That's 57.6 radioactive tons thrown into the air by fire and explosions. The tiny radioactive and burning smoke particles have traveled around the world many times since 1979, killing an estimated 1 million people to date from radiation-caused illnesses and cancers. This is according to editor Dr. Jeanette Sherman's exhaustive and widely acclaimed book on 5,000 Chernobyl scientific pages recently published by the New York Academy of Sciences. Fukushima Daiichi equals 50-plus Chernobyls. As Dr. Miko Kaku, a well-renowned Sunni theoretical physicist, pointed out on CNN March 18, 2011. Chernobyl involved one reactor and only 57.6 tons of the reactor core went into the atmosphere. In dramatic contrast, the Fukushima Daiichi disaster immediately involved six reactors, and IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, documented 2,800 tons of highly radioactive old reactor cores.
Let's see.
Symbol division tells us there are at least 48.6 Chernobyls in the burning old reactor cores pumping fiery isotopes into the Earth's atmosphere. It is no stretch to say that Fukushima Daiichi's 6 reactors and the dry holding pools for the old reactor cores are equal to more than 50 Chernobyl disasters.
Yeah.
Further clarification is needed, of course, and is being worked out now by independent physicists. Note that the lethality of radioactive reactor cores goes up the first 250,000 years they are out of the reactor, not down. Looking at the current Japanese meltdown is more than 50 Chernobyls is just the start. In addition, the fate of the four nearby reactors of the Fukushima Daiichi is as yet unknown by the outside world. Working at the nearby reactors only 10 kilometers is quick, painful death sentence. They are inside the mandatory evacuation zone. This much is known. All radioactive exposures are cumulative for each human, animal, and plant. What's more, mutated genetic codes are passed on to the offspring forever. This means all Japanese and all Northern Hemisphere inhabitants are suffering internal radioactive contamination from the Fukushima Daiichi reactors already. Fukushima equals 3,000 billion lethal doses.
Three trillion lethal doses.
Dr. Paolo Scampa, a widely known EU physicist, single-handedly popularized the easily understood lethal doses concept. Lethal doses is a worldwide, well-understood idea that strips physics bare and offers a brilliant, understandable explanation for all the physics gobbledygook intelligence agencies and their respective governments use to disguise the brutal truth of the Fukushima Daiichi disaster.
Fukushima from 21,000 feet, there's a picture. The 3,000 billion or 3 trillion lethal doses of radiation mean there are 429 lethal doses chasing each and every one of us on the planet. To put it in a nutshell, this is up to from about 70 billion lethal doses on March 23rd, 2011. It is getting worse every day without any intervention by the U.S. and the other nuclear powers. Veterans today call on the world's nuclear powers to intervene sooner rather than later. It is up to the world only remaining superpower, the United States, to get the Japan reactor disaster intervention meeting officially underway. The Fukushima kill already underway worldwide will certainly dwarf that of Chernobyl. All of U.S. superpower President Obama's delay does. I'm sorry. All U.S. superpower President Obama's delay does in increase the number of the kill. That is a clear choice. We call on President Obama to revisit that choice. Further, the genetic and DNA changing aspects of the radioactivity now in the air spreading worldwide within a year will spawn a grotesque new assortment of radiation degraded mutants, both human and of other life forms.
Many of these creatures in the animal world will not survive long outside the womb if carried to term. What's more, the future human genetic mutants of ever lower intelligence and greater and more grotesque physical deformities are the genetic legacy of humanity forever. That is the new starting point for any rational and reality-based national or foreign policy. What we now know about Fukushima. Here's what we know. More than 75 days after 6 reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactor plant started a disastrous and lethal nuclear meltdown on March 11, 2011. March 11, 1446. A 1 million kiloton earthquake measuring 9.0 on the Richter scale hammered Japan offshore near the 6 Japanese reactors. The reactors attempted to shut down automatically when electronic sensors detected the earthquake. The huge earthquake dropped the reactors 3 feet, moved Japan 8 inches to the west, and altered the tilt of the axis of the planet Earth. Oh, my God. March 11th, about 15 giant earthquake caused a tsunami up to 30 meters, that's 98.4 feet high, washed away all the fuel tanks for the reactor's emergency generators and all the reactor's outside electrical feeds. This was the death blow to the reactors. The six Fukushima Daiichi reactors were dead in the water and their fate sealed. Without an external source of electricity for the water pumps and hot reactors, they are just so much radioactive scrap iron, good for nothing. The internal temperature of the reactors started climbing immediately.
March 11th, about 1,800 hours, only 2.5 hours later, multiple reactor cores started melting down as the reactor's internal temperature skyrocketed to the melting point of uranium and beyond, a measured 1,718 DEG degree. Oh, okay.
1,718.
Yeah, 1,718 degrees centigrade.
Mm-hmm.
Past
the melting point.
Well, that's bizarre. But they have 1,700 degrees centigrade. Oh, I see. Okay, Fahrenheit, yeah.
Yeah.
Or 3,124.4 degrees Fahrenheit past the melting point. Uranium melts at 1,132 degrees centigrade, or 2,069.9 degrees Fahrenheit. So this is 1,000 degrees hotter than the melting point of uranium. All right, the internal reactor temperatures reached at least 2,850 degrees centigrade, or 5,162 degrees Fahrenheit.
Can you imagine that heat?
God, the millions of one millimeter uranium fuel pellets in the reactors and in the core pools had no defense at all without the powerful water pumps and billions of gallons of cooling water against those temperatures. The uranium pellets simply melted, forming a white hot lava like radioactive uranium isotopes blob that was and probably still is superheated by the power of the uranium atom itself. A highly radioactive blob then burned through the graphite seals of the General Electric Mark I reactor control rods at the bottom of the American submarine base reactors design of U.S. Navy Admiral Hyman Rickover, now deceased. And General Electric copied the U.S. government-financed Navy nuclear reactor design for many commercial nuclear reactors. The radioactive blobs trickled out of hundreds of control rod holes instead of melting together to form a single giant, highly radioactive burning lava blob like that of Chernobyl. The solution then and now has changed. World-famous theoretical physicist Dr. Niko Kaku caught the world's attention on March 18, 2011. CNN broadcast when he suggested the Prime Minister of Japan immediately choose this Chernobyl option for the Fukushima Daiichi General Electric reactors.
Kaku said the Japanese Prime Minister should order the Japanese Air Self-Defense Force to bomb the reactors into submission with boron, sand, water, and concrete, like the Red Army did to kill them out of the out-of-control Chernobyl reactor on orders of the USSR President Gorbachev. Boron absorbs neutrons, the radioactive hearts of the reactors. The time for Dr. Kuko's Chernobyl option is past. Multiple explosions destroyed the reactors in the swimming pools holding of old reactor cores weeks ago. Hundreds to thousands of tons of burning, highly radioactive reactor cores are scattered all over the Fukushima Daiichi site. The reactors are releasing as much as TEPCO measured 20 quintillion or 10,000 trillion BQs of radioactive counts per second of deadly radioactive smoke particles into the Earth's atmosphere. The invisible killing radioactive smoke is already all over the Northern Hemisphere and everyone in it, and each and everyone is radiologically contaminated. The scope of Dr. Kaku's once brilliant form of solution is unfortunately now too small and ineffective. Generally speaking, most radiation cannot escape into the atmosphere if it is covered by water. Honshu, Japan, is an island, and the Pacific Ocean is conveniently located nearby. U.S. President Barack Obama, official portrait, U.S. government. Looking at
he looks
him.
Like a complete asshole.
Subsistence changes. Subsistence multiple
subsidence.
Yes, subsidence changes from multiple nuclear weapons buried by drilling rigs 500 feet below and inland of the string of six reactors must be engineered to slide the reactors into the sea. This method works best if there's an igneous or volcanic rock behind the subsidence charges to bounce the blast. Oh, charges, subsidence charges, we
yeah.
said changes.
Oh.
To bounce the blast and pressure wave from and push the trashed reactors area of the beachfront into the sea.
Well,
I don't know if I like that.
No, I mean, especially equipped submarines can then pick up the pieces of reactor core from underwater. The surge of the surface of the ocean blocks the escape of radiation. The submarine must work fast to limit killing more of the Earth's oceans. Yeah, right. And veterans today call on President Obama to authorize the disposal of the six reactors at sea and the collection of the deadly radioactive metals with submarines. We cannot, we conclude there are no other options left. The do-nothing option allows the deaths and maiming of many millions of people to rapidly proceed, doing nothing but, by default, allowing the Fukushima kill to ruthlessly continue unabated. Doing nothing is also not acceptable from a practical standpoint because Japan does not own the nuclear weapons to use themselves and nuke the reactors of Fukushima Daiichi right into the sea, Mr. President. So,
oh, I don't know if that's
I don't think so either.
I don't know about
the reactors.
I don't know why they didn't just drop all that boron on and sand and concrete on top of it.
Because they were idiots. They're just complete idiots. And they don't know what the hell they're doing. Or, much worse, they were told not to do anything. You see, folks, what we're dealing with here is you're really dealing with a.
You don't know what their agenda is.
No, you're dealing with a New World Order kind of crap here. And that's, you know, that's something that really, we're talking about people that want to do away with the world. Right?
Yeah, they don't want to have so many people, and you're in the way.
The world. Yeah, exactly. So,
we're all in the way.
Yeah. So if they can kill off a third of the planet or half of the planet and leave the rest of the planet mutant apes, like, you know, it's like Zardos, like that movie Zardos. Everybody was, except for a select few, were all mutants.
Yeah.
You know? And we're reverted back to barbarians, you know. And that's what happened supposedly 25,000 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, a man was a barbarian because of nuclear war. Another problem. So it's like we just haven't learned. We haven't learned. Six situation.
Do we have another health? That you were concentrating on health this segment.
Yes, my second one was I wanted to talk about aspartame tonight because there was a great article on that. Here it is.
Amid health fears.
Yeah,
Diet Coke sweetener in safety spotlight.
An artificial sweetener used in Diet Coke is to undergo an urgent EU safety review. Aspartame is ingested every day by millions of people around the world in more than 6,000 well-known brands of food, drink, and medicine. However, it has been the subject of a number of studies that appear to show harmful effects on human health. One recent study linked diet drinks containing aspartame to premature births, while others suggested it could cause cancer. This is Mail Online. To date, health watchdogs include the European Food Safety Authority and the UK's Food Safe Standards Agency have ruled out any link to ill health. That's crap. Bullshit. We've read so many articles on aspartame that cause cancer. Okay, but after several MEPs asked for a new investigation following pressure from European health campaigners, the EU Commissioner Commission officials have now asked the EFSA to bring forward a review that had been planned for 2020. Yeah. The concern about artificial sweeteners such as aspartame relates to the fact that they contain methanol, a nerve toxin, which can be metabolized in the body to form two more nerve toxins, formic acid and formaldehyde, the chemicals used to preserve dead bodies.
Lovely.
Earlier this year, experts on Britain's Committee on Toxicity ruled that long-term exposure to methanol consumed through food, including from aspartame, is unlikely to be harmful to health. The committee pointed out that the methanol is also found in fruit and vegetables. That's bullshit. As a result of the experts' conclusion, the FSA ruled the consumption of aspartame is not of concern of the current levels of use. But despite the verdict, the FSA is currently recruiting volunteers for an investigation into anecdotal reports of ill health, including headaches, stomach aches associated with aspartame. The watchdog announced the research project in 2009. However, it has had difficulty recruiting volunteers who claim to suffer problems. EFSA spokesman Lucia DeLuca said aspartame is one of hundreds of flavorings. It is on the market because it has been assessed in the past and considered safe. We have received official requests with a complete reevaluation of the safety. All right. Well, where's the bad news? There was some bad news here. Is this a whitewash?
That's the kind of.
It looks like both of them have been evaluated. It looks like a whitewash. But we know for a fact that it isn't, and we know for a fact that it has caused.
There are a lot of studies. There are a lot of studies that contradict this.
I'm surprised it's on here. I'm very surprised it's on there.
Well, you like to know what the other side is saying.
Yeah, because it's. But it's a sick fact.
Well, why don't you go into the Pepsi one? That's
disgusting. Huh? No,
there's an article on Pepsi, which is very disturbing.
If you think you like Coke or Pepsi,
maybe on the next.
Yeah, if you like Coke or Pepsi, I think you got to change your mind about Pepsi.
We can't find it. We're looking, folks, so.
Huh. Oh, you know what? I think I know. I think I'm on the other page. Yeah. It'll back one.
Okay. Sears over fluoride. Big Pharma is attempting to corner the market on marijuana.
Yeah, I think this is an important tool here. Where is it? Down here, right?
I thought it was towards the bottom, but maybe it's...
Oh, you know what? Maybe it's got to be the next one. First page.
Uses aborted fetal cells in flavor enhancers.
This is true.
Let's just read this. Scores of pro-life groups are calling for a public boycott of food giant PepsiCo due to its partnership with Sinomix, a biotech company that uses aborted fetal cells in their research and development of artificial flavor enhancers. LifeSite News previously reported on Sinomix's partnership with major food corporations, most notably PepsiCo, Kraft Foods, and Nestle. Pro-life watchdog group Children of God for Life is now joined by major pro-life organizations calling upon the public to target PepsiCo in a boycott. Pepsi is funding the research and development and paying royalties to Sinomix, which uses HEK-293, human embryonic kidney cells, to produce flavor enhancers for Pepsi beverages. Oh, that makes me sick.
That is disgusting. You know, guys, stay away from anything that Pepsi makes, okay? PepsiCo, let's see. Using isolated human taste receptors. We've created a proprietary, taste receptor-based assay systems that provide a biochemical or electronic readout when a flavor ingredient interacts with the receptor, says Simoex website. What they do not tell the public is that they are using HEK293, human embryonic kidney cells taken from an elective aborted baby, to produce those receptors. Stated Debbie Vinage, president for CGL, the watchdog group that has been monitoring the use of aborted fetal material in medical products and cosmetics for years. The aborted fetal cells are not in the product itself. However, there are many options PepsiCo could be using instead of aborted fetal cells. The revelation about Simonix research techniques motivated Campbell Soup to sever all relations with Simonix. I would hope so. However, PepsiCo continues their business relationship despite the abortion connection. They drew public ire earlier this year when they responded, saying, "Our collaboration with Simonix is strictly limited to creating lower-calorie, great-tasting beverages for consumers." When pressed further, PepsiCo sent out a former letter response saying they had been accused of conducting abortal fetal tissue research. Bradley Mates, executive director of Life Issues Institute, said, "While aborted fetal cells aren't actually in the product itself, the close relationship is enough to repulse most consumers. To our knowledge, this is the first time a food product has been publicly associated with abortion." And the pro-life groups noted that additional companies collaborating with Senomex will be targeted for a boycott next. The pro-life organizations are asking the public to boycott all Pepsi drinking products and encourage consumers to contact Pepsi management, requesting that they never sever all ties with Senomex. The list of Pepsi beverages included in the boycott: PepsiCo brands, Pepsi Cola brands. To contact, go to PepsiCo.com/brands/Pepsi underscore.
Oh, that's a little
Cola.
One.
Yeah.
Come to this article and you can see it yourself.
Yeah, really. Or you can contact PepsiCo. Yeah, forget it. It's too long. Pro-life groups joining sale. You go to this site. Go to this check. I'm going to post this on, it's called LifeSite News. What I'm going to do, I'm going to post this up online.
Put it on Facebook. And
on my Facebook.
People,
and you can go to leosteel.com.
You can.
Leo Steel, rather. On Facebook, if you're following me on Facebook at all. Let me put this here. I put it right up on Facebook now.
You can go right to Leo's site and read the article yourself. There it is. Articles and some audios and some things from YouTube.
Oh, anyway. Yeah, check this out. I just posted that on my Facebook video still. All right.
Let's go back to
it. There it is.
For you all to read.
Yes. I wanted to check out one more. There was one more article that I wanted to bring up tonight. And that was the, I lost it. I lost it.
Well, just go back to the main site that we were on.
I was going to. I can't find it now.
Go to favorites.
I can't. No, it's not in favorites. Oh. This is another one that I have.
For Legit Gov?
Yeah. I put that up because they had so many articles on Fukushima.
Yep.
But I wanted, but the one I wanted to end with tonight, and I can't get it here. I'll go up here and find it. Was the one on BP? Are they screwing over everybody, and they want to drop all these claims now?
Oh yeah, I'm not surprised.
No, I mean, you know, BP is such a big.
Well, they didn't even pay the people in Alaska, so
company,
I don't know why the people thought they were going to get paid in itself.
Yeah, but you know what really bothered me is, and everybody seems to, this was not mentioned, but originally they put aside $40 billion. That was
right.
The amount settled.
That's,
all of a sudden, it suddenly turned to $20 billion.
I read that a few months
ago. Yeah, and nobody seemed, and now they seem to be dropping everybody, trying to drop everybody, everybody's claims. I can damn find that thing again.
Just go to David Icke.
I'm trying. I had a bookmark there. I can't find it in the bookmark. Here it is. Right. You can find this, a lot of this news on David Icke's website. Okay. DavidIcke.com. There it is. All right. BP wants thousands of oil spill claims tossed.
A BP attorney told the federal judge Thursday that thousands of lawsuits for economic damages must be dismissed because they will file before claimants tried to settle through BP's $20 billion Gulf Coast claims facility administered by Kenneth Feinberg. Oil spill defendants also claimed immunity from liability for the toxic dispersant Corexit, saying they simply made decisions they should have been made by the United States government.
BP and other oil spill defendants, including Nalco, which makes Corexit, told U.S. District Judge Carl Barbier that
they are
immune from liability because they were simply following orders that should have been handed down by the President of the United States under the National Emergencies Contingency Plan. But EPA told these bastards not to use it, and they continued to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, if Obama is responsible for this and allowed it, then that bastard should be shot and broiled, all right? Let's see. BP and other oil spill defendants, including now, okay. The point we are trying to make, Your Honor, is that the claims the plaintiffs are making that the disbursements are too dangerous, except these were decisions that should have been made by the United States government. Attorney for Nalco, Barbara told the hearing.
Mary Rose Alexander, attorney for Nalco, told Judge Barbier toward the hearing's ending.
BP attorney Andrew Langan said that the Oil Pollution Act was set up to help claimants settle out of court. He said that one stipulation for filing an economic damage suit against BP is that the claimant must have filed a claim with the Gulf Coast Claims Facility and been denied. But now that the lawsuits have been filed, Barbier, who is presiding over the consolidated litigation, wondered how to address the issue of presentment to the GCCF. I could rule as a matter of law, which you have asked me to do, but I don't want to down the road have to deal with individual rulings on 100,000 claims, Barbara told Langan. Earlier Thursday, Barbara said the number of lawsuits so far filed in the multi-district litigation is probably something north of 120,000 to 130,000 cases. 95,000 claimants have joined the litigation by filing short-form joiners that were
created
to allow plaintiffs to join the litigation without excessive paperwork. The GCCF, meanwhile, has been criticized for requiring extensive documentation for claimants. And Gulf Coast lawmakers this past winter expressed frustration with the claim center, saying BP and Feinberg were intentionally stalling responses to claims to lure desperate claimants into accepting one-time quick payments of $25,000 for businesses or $5,000 for individuals. The payments require a signed waiver stating the claimants won't litigate for more damages from BP or any of the other oil defendants. BP's position is that any people who have claims should decide this out of court. Oh, jeez. Langan said he knows what filing through the GCCF is a huge inconvenience for the plaintiffs, and he understands the plaintiff's steering committee wants to take the matters to court and stick their stake in the ground. But he said OPA guidelines still apply. And the next issue addressed was whether people who have lost wages because of federal drilling moratorium can file a claim with BP. It is our position that but for
causation,
he just blew me away.
Defined but for causation is that which arrives through a thought process like, but for the oil spill, I would still have a job. If but for the causation were the standard, there would be no end to OPA litigation, Langan said.
I would keep arguments moving to stay with the 3-hour allotted for the hearing.
But this article goes on and on.
But you want to check this article out, I highly recommend it. Courthouse News Service, BP wants thousands of oil spill claims tossed.
By Sabrina
Canfield. Right. What a piece of work.
It's from New Orleans.
Goddamn BP. And that's pretty much our news for tonight. There's a lot more out there, but, you know, we got to...
Oh, there was so much today, so I hope you guys take a few minutes to look at the news yourselves. We brought you the things that we thought were of interest, and we want to thank Gail Corey Townsend for being our guest tonight, and we look forward to hearing from her again, maybe on her trip to the Gaza, or certainly when she comes home.
Yeah.
Good night, folks, and
don't forget,
enjoy the rest
of the night. You can go to Natural News for this one. Naturalnews.com. Big Pharma attempting to corner the market on medical marijuana. That's right, folks. So anyway, I want to thank you all for joining us tonight. We wish you a very happy week. And please join us tomorrow night when we bring you more big news. Okay? Big, big news. So have a good evening, folks. And see you then. Let's see if I can get my...